Gesture by Howard Jones.
My name is Philip Morris. This story is not about me, but it might be helpful if I explain how I came to write it. I'm a sports journalist and author, currently employed by the Bransfield Daily News to report on the fortunes, or more often the misfortunes, of Bransfield Town Football Club in the winter and the county cricket team in the summer. An enviable trade, you may think, and far better than real work. I write under the name of The Captain, a generic title which has been used by the sports writer for the Bransfield News since the paper was founded. I'm not from Bransfield originally, having been born, brought up and educated near Winchester. My father's a railwayman, so even though I did well in grammar school, a university place was financially impossible. I'd always enjoyed writing, and my ambition was to become a journalist. So I applied to the Hampshire Gazette for a role as an office junior, in the hope that I could progress to become a junior reporter. Fortunately, after a couple of years, a vacancy arose and I applied for and got the role of junior crime reporter. My days were therefore spent listening to and passing on to the general public the wit and wisdom of a local bench, all of whom were male at that time. To avoid any possible confusion, I confirmed that they remained male for the rest of their lives, but that lady magistrates did not appear until the 1920s. When war came in 1914, I volunteered, but my medical examination revealed that I was short-sighted and unsuitable to be a frontline soldier. On discovering that I was a journalist, I was enrolled as a press officer, attached to the general staff at their headquarters at Saint-Omer initially, then Montreuil-sur-Mer. This seemed to me to be a very rare example of the army putting a round peg into a round hole. It meant that I had a first-hand opportunity to see very senior officers about their business, and the very great strain upon them as casualties mounted and the pressure from politicians back in Britain increased. It also provided my only first-hand experience of action when the HQ building was bombed in 1918. After the war, I rejoined the newspaper, but now as a sports reporter. In 1920, the Football League was extended to include the former Southern League clubs, so Portsmouth now became a Football League club, and I reported on them both home and away. Hampshire County Cricket Club, whilst not winning the county championship, were a reasonably good team, so I had a good standard of sport to write about. However, my wife comes from Bransfield and was anxious to return to that area to be nearer her elderly parents. When, therefore, a vacancy arose at the Bransfield Daily News, I applied. I didn't mention that I was short-sighted, despite the fact that, according to most football and cricket supporters, it was an essential qualification for the job. Much to my surprise, I was offered the job and decided to accept it, even though it meant moving 250 miles north from leafy Hampshire to industrial Yorkshire. The consolation was that the top football teams were all in the north, as were strong county cricket teams. That was in 1923. In the last 15 years, I've become very attached to the North and its people, and I would like to think that I've become accepted. I admire the honesty of the people and the sense of community, evident in the choirs and brass bands. Something I felt was often lacking in the wealthier but more self-centred South. I mentioned that I'm an author as well as a reporter, and I was looking for a suitable subject for a book. It so happened that this year is the 50th anniversary of the founding of the football club, and I could write a club history. However, I had something niggling away at the back of my mind concerning my war service as a press officer. This largely involved feeding the press, and therefore the public, the version of events according to the military general staff. Since the war, the politicians and senior officers have produced their memoirs justifying their own actions. I was concerned that the views of the ordinary soldiers had never been recorded, at least not from a British point of view. All Quiet on the Western Front was a classic book and subsequent film, but written by a German. Siegfried Sassoon has written memoirs of an infantry officer, but from an officer's perspective. Could I wondered, combine the two? A history of Branfield FC, but including the war recollections of any of their players who had fought. Would they be willing to talk to me? It is well known that survivors of the war were reluctant to talk about their experiences. What were their views of the Germans then and now? How did they feel about the politicians that had been unable to prevent the catastrophe, and the generals who had given the orders that led to so many deaths? Had their opinions changed over the last 20 years? There was also a current issue that concerned both football and the Germans. The England football team was shortly to begin a continental tour and were due to play Germany at the Olympic Stadium in Berlin, and the debate was raging in the press about whether the England team should give the Nazi salute. Jim Gibson, a Bransfield player who could possibly be selected for the tour, had just become engaged to the daughter of one of the former players and soldiers that I had in mind to interview. What would George Roberts' thoughts be on this? I happened to bump into Jim in the club bar after a match and asked him if he thought I should contact his future father-in-law. He suggested that I write to George seeking an interview, but added that he would probably want his great pal Reg Perkins to be present. I knew of Reg as a top player before the war, and that he'd lost his sight after being wounded on the Somme. It seemed to me to be a chance to kill two birds with one stone. I therefore wrote to George, outlining my plans and seeking his cooperation.
There's the post. Usual rubbish, I expect. I don't know who this is from.
Well, there's only one way to find out.
It's addressed to you. Here we are.
Let's have a look. It's from the Bransfield News. A Philip Morris said he'd write in a history of Bransfield Town. I'd like to interview former players, especially those who went on to serve in the war. Would I and Reg be available for interview at a time and place to suit ourselves? Yeah. I wonder if he's the captain. Yeah, whether he intends to write the book in the lounge bar of the Midland Hotel. I'm sure that's where he reports on the matches from.
Well, what do you think? You've always been reluctant to talk about the war, even to me.
Well, things I'd rather not recall. Especially in front of a stranger. Yeah, on the other hand, the politicians and generals all had their say, so yeah, perhaps an ordinary Tommy should put something on record. Tell you what, let's talk to Reg about it after the match on Saturday.
Sounds like good sense to me. Anyway, you better get off to work, and I've got plenty to be getting on with.
That was a good way to end the season, a 3-0 win, and young Gibson getting two of them. Wonder if he'll get selected for the tour. 23 goals this season. He should have a chance.
You know what a committee on the selectors is like. Yeah, a lot of horse trading to get their own favourites picked. As someone said, we've got the players, all we need to do is to find the selectors to pick them. Anyways, a lot of competition for centre-forward. Here, blokes like, you know, Ted Drake, Frank Broom. Hey, young Tommy Lawton got 28 goals this season.
George, did you mention to Reg about the letter at the match?
Yeah, no, didn't have the time. Besides, I thought you and Elsie should be here.
Well, what letter was that?
Oh, you tell him, love.
George has had a letter from a journalist who wants to write a history of Bransfield Town, but wants to include information about some of the players, especially those who fought in the war. He asked whether you and George would talk to him.
What do you think, George?
I'll do it if you will. Yeah, and I think Maggie and Elsie should be there. After all, a lot of our story is their story too.
Yeah, fair enough. How about one night next week, eh? Say, Wednesday at 7 o'clock in our house? All right with you, Elsie?
Fine.
Yeah, right. I'll drop him a line. Let him know your address.
Well, we'd better be off. See you on Wednesday, then.
The reply came more quickly than I expected. I spent the next couple of days listing the questions I wanted to ask. The football season had finished and the first day of the county cricket match was washed out, so I had a bit of time. I looked forward to Wednesday evening with a mixture of excitement and apprehension. I knew that talking about the war could provoke strong emotions.
It's nearly 7 o'clock. He should be here in any minute. Not too late if you want to change your minds.
Well, I've been having second thoughts, but I suppose the thing is, if he asks about anything we'd rather not speak about, well, we can say so.
I'll go.
Mrs. Perkins, I'm Philip Morris. I arranged to come and speak to your husband and Mr. Roberts and to you and Mrs. Roberts.
Yes, of course. Come in. Can I get you a drink or anything?
That's kind of you, but I had tea not long ago.
Go through to the front room. We're all in there.
How do you do? Now, this is George Roberts and his wife Maggie. Sit yourself down.
Thanks. And thank you for agreeing to see me. I'd just like to say before we start that if I stray into areas that you'd rather not talk about, please say so. I mentioned in my letter that I'm writing a history of Bransfield Town. I can get a lot of information from our archives, but I want to tell the story with first-hand accounts from people involved. I also want to include the war experiences of players. I don't want the politicians and generals to have it all their own way.
Yeah, fair enough. But where do you want to start?
I know that you're both local lads and went to school together. Perhaps we could talk about how you came to play for the town.
Yeah, I'd better tell you that. Afraid you'd be too modest. No, he was always going to be a professional, having been an outstanding player in school, having had a trial for England schools. It was no surprise that the town signed him up as ground staff boy as soon as he left school.
What did that involve?
Oh, sweeping the terraces, cleaning the boots, and in the summer, painting anything that didn't move, whether it needed it or not. In the afternoons, we trained, not with a ball. Our trainer had an idea that if we didn't see the ball in the week, we could take greater care of it during the matches. Seemed a bit odd. After all, you can't learn to play a violin just by reading sheets of music.
How long was it before you got into the first team?
Oh, 5 years. I started off in the third team in the county league. That was hard. Playing against ex-pros who knew all the tricks and youngsters who weren't going to make it but liked to kick those who were. But it was a good way to learn.
How about you, Mr. Roberts?
You call me George, if you like. Well, I was nothing special in school. I was a bit on the small side, and size matters a lot at that age. I did all right at school, but I was better with my hands, so I did well at woodwork. So when I left school, I applied for an apprenticeship at Marsden's Piano Works. I was lucky enough to get in. They had a works football team then, as most places did, so I played for them. Major Marsden used to come and watch sometimes. He was also chairman of Bransfield Town. One day, after I'd been there for about 4 years, he called me into his office. I wondered what I'd done wrong, whether I was for the sack. Much to my surprise, he said he'd been watching me play and thought I could make it as a professional, and suggested that I had a trial so the training staff could see me. Well, they must have liked what they saw. I was offered terms. I talked it all with my father, thought I should complete my apprenticeship. I could see the sense in this, so I signed on as a part-timer for 12 months. After a while, I found myself playing in the reserves with Reg, before he made his debut in the first team. A couple of years later, I joined him.
I recall we were a decent side in those days.
Yeah, we were all right. Never threatened to win the league, but never looked like going down either. Had a couple of good cup runs. got to the last eight in 1912. But as a reward, we went on an end-of-season tour of Germany. Well, at least northern Germany. We were invited to watch their cup final. In Hamburg, wasn't it, George?
Yeah, it was won by a team from Kiel. Only goal was a penalty. The knees may be a bit shaky, but the memory seems to be all right. Yeah, they invited us to their party after the game. Like, yeah, lots of beer and sausage, or worst, I think they called it.
How did you get on with them?
Oh, fine. The funny thing is, we couldn't speak any German, and they only spoke a few words of English. But we seemed to be able to understand one another. We had a great time, laughing and joking. It was as if football became a common language.
Did you sense that there was trouble ahead?
No. We were just footballers enjoying an end-of-season trip. I'm wondering whether our girlfriends would be waiting for us when we got back. They were, and I married Maggie in April 1914. And Reg married Agnes a month later.
I'm sorry, but I thought your wife's name is Elsie.
It is. Agnes was my first wife. She died in 1918, during the flu epidemic. She was a VAD during the war, and likely as not caught it from the soldiers she was nursing. Only 30 years old. But then that type of flu attacked younger people. More people died of that than during the war. I often think she was just as much a casualty of the war as all those lads buried in France and Belgium.
Can I ask how you managed?
I went back to living with my parents. The major allowed me to train as a piano tuner, and that's how I met Elsie. Yeah, you tell him the story, love.
I was a music teacher, and from time to time, Reg came to school to tune the piano. I was not interested in football, and had no idea that he'd been famous. He used to come into the staff room for a cup of tea. We got chatting and found that we had interests in common, the theatre, nature and so on. One day, one of the children ran up to me and asked if I knew that Reg had been a famous player, and that's how I found out. Typically modest of him not to have said anything. Our friendship gradually developed. Neither of us were kids. We were both in our 40s when we got married in 1930. Your turn, Maggie. Tell Philip how you and George met.
I was on a suffragette march through the town. A group of young men were shouting what they thought were amusing comments, but were quite rude. I noticed one man telling them to shut up. It developed into a bit of pushing and shoving. Fortunately, a policeman came along and sorted them out. I thanked the man and we got chatting. By chance, we met again a couple of weeks later at the Palais and things developed from there. Well, in case you're wondering, I was not in favour of violent acts like breaking shop windows or blowing up letterboxes. I only became part of the movement when I heard about the harsh treatment of women prisoners. You know, force feeding and so on. A lot of people joined when they heard about that.
So shortly after you both got married, war was declared.
Yes, although I still didn't see it coming, even after that Archduke and his wife were killed. What did something happening the other side of Europe have to do with us? I remember seeing a newspaper headline saying, "Trouble in the Balkans," and thinking it was some sort of embarrassing medical condition.
Did you know that the Archduke had asked that his mausoleum should be light and airy so he could read the morning paper? I don't suppose he expected to occupy it quite so soon, and the terrible consequences that had for everyone. So, did you chaps volunteer as soon as you could?
We tried to, but they were overwhelmed with volunteers and didn't need us. Everyone was caught up in a sort of patriotic frenzy. The newspapers were feeding us with stories of German atrocities, raping nuns and baiting babies. But I don't know that any evidence was found. Yeah, that Horatio Bottomley was going round the country making speeches. What a crook he turned out to be. I think he got 7 years for fraud after the war. Something to do with war savings bonds. We were 28 years old and fit, but they meant for younger single men. So we carried on playing football for another season. There was a lot of criticism of football for doing that. But I think the lads on leave saw it as a distraction. If you look at photographs of the cup final in 1915, most of the crowd were in uniform. It was known as the khaki final.
What would you say was the main reason you volunteered?
Well, I felt it was our duty, but I suppose it was made mostly to support our mates. Do you agree, George?
Yes. Although we were footballers, we were the same as everyone else.
So when did you go into the army?
Oh, it was towards the end of 1915. We were part of Kitchener's new army, being built up for a large-scale offensive to try and bring the war to an end.
So what happened next?
Oh, we went off to a training camp. I think it was in March 1916 that we went across to France, to the huge camp at El Tarplis. Then in June we moved up to the reserve trenches. It was obvious that the big push was coming by all the activity. Guns were being moved up, troops were everywhere. The Germans must have been expecting it and kept sending up observation balloons, which our lot kept shooting down. Yeah, they were real death traps. There must have been brave men to go up in those things.
Yeah, it was while I was at training camp in England that I had a letter from Maggie to tell me that she was pregnant and the baby was due in the summer. We had embarkation leave before going to France, so I was able to see it.
The bombardment started in the last week of June, and it went on for 6 days. It was deafening. The ground was shaking like an earthquake was happening. I remember saying to George that I almost felt sorry for the Germans.
Well, perhaps this is a good time to ask you what you felt about the Germans. Did you ever feel hatred towards them?
It's difficult to describe. I thought back to our tour in Germany in 1912 and the hospitality they gave us. Yet here they were, trying to kill me and my mates. So, yes, I suppose I did hate them. That's what made you aggressive enough to want to kill them. But when there was a lull in the fighting, we looked after each other's wounded and gave any prisoners a fag. I don't know how to explain it.
Think back to Christmas 1914. Killing each other one day, exchanging presents and playing football together the next, and then back to killing each other. It's beyond understanding.
And what are your feelings now?
Well, as far as the ordinary German soldiers are concerned, they suffered as much as we did. It's the politicians I blame for involving us in it in the first place. If we're not careful, they'll do it again.
And what do you think about the generals who gave the orders that cost so much?
Well, firstly, I agree with what George has just said. Looking back over 20 years, I don't blame the generals either. We were all trapped in a nightmare that no one knew how to get out of, other than more of the same. And if we had one more soldier left at the end than the others, we had won. It was the Americans coming in that tipped the balance for us. Otherwise, who knows what might have happened.
Do you want to talk about the first day of the Somme?
Well, we've come this far. Might as well finish the story. The brigadier came to talk to us the night before. Said that nothing could have survived the bombardment. And all we'd have to do is walk across no man's land, through the wire, which would be destroyed, and occupy the Germans' lines before pushing on to the next objective. Our battalion was in reserve. The shelling stopped at 7:25, and there was an eerie silence until 7:30. Then the whistle sounded, to begin the advance. The German lines were about 400 yards away on the crest of a hill. There was a silence for a couple of minutes, and we began to think the brigadier had been right. Then we heard the German machine guns open up.
The plan was that we would advance to our front line trenches, ready to cross no man's land once the word came back that the first wave had captured the German trenches. The order came at about 10 o'clock, and we moved up in readiness. Eventually we were told to move off and occupy the German trenches. So we set off across no man's land. I don't want to talk about what we saw. I mean, you know the casualty figures and the cost of advancing a few hundred yards. The wire was mostly still intact. The Germans, who'd been there 2 years, had built deep shelters, so their artillery was not effective. That and the time between the bombardment stopping and our lads walking, carrying 60-pound packs, it gave them plenty of time to come up and man their machine guns. We stayed in those trenches for 3 months, sending out raiding parties. It was on one of these that I got wounded, and that was the end of my war. It was a bang and a flash, and the next thing I knew, I was woke up in the field hospital with my eyes bandaged before being sent back to Blighty.
How about you, George?
Why, served out the rest of the war, didn't get so much as a scratch. I've often thought about it. Why, I should have been so lucky when the others were not. Fate, I suppose.
Did you get home at all to see the baby?
I had a letter from Maggie telling me that Rosie had been born on the morning of the 1st of July, the morning of the attack, and that all was well. I managed to get compassionate leave for a week and got home. Yeah, the hardest thing was going back again and leaving them. The thing was, I knew what to expect this time, but I was determined to get through it, and luckily I did.
What did you do after the war? Were you still able to play football?
No, I was too old for league football. I played part-time and went back to Marsden's as a carpenter.
Have you heard of the row about whether the England team should give the Nazis salute?
I don't think they should. The papers are full of stories about what's going on in Germany. They've already occupied Austria, and Hitler's making claims on part of Czechoslovakia.
I don't know, it's only a salute. Do that, then give them a good beating in a match. I remember Derby County giving the salute a few years back, all except the goalkeeper. Yeah, but they're always different.
I agree with George. It's only a symbolic gesture.
I can think of a gesture I'd like to give them.
There are a couple of your team I'd like to ask about. Sean Murphy and Hugh Podmore. Sean first, what do you remember about him?
He was the goalkeeper. Came to us from a side in Dublin. He went back to Ireland after football finished for the war. I believe he was killed in the Civil War after the treaty in 1921.
Do you remember him expressing any views on Irish independence?
Not really. He kept himself to himself on political matters.
What about Hugh Podmore?
Poor old Hugh. He was an amateur, ex-public schoolboy. He was commissioned, but suffered a breakdown and was treated at Craig Lockhart Hospital near Edinburgh. I believe he was there at the same time as Siegfried Sassoon. He was past as fit to return to active service and survived the war and moved down to Hampshire to live. Sadly, murdered his wife in a fit of temper, wrongly thinking she was having an affair. Whilst he admitted that he'd killed his wife, his defence was that it was whilst his mind was disturbed after his war experiences. Several eminent psychologists testified that he was fit to plead and of sound mind. The jury found him guilty, but recommended mercy, but The Home Secretary saw no reason to interfere with the course of justice, and he was hanged.
Yes. I was in Hampshire at that time, and remember the trial in Winchester and the protests over his execution. Many were appalled at the lack of sympathy shown to him, especially in view of his war service, and thought that perhaps he and his wife were also casualties of the war. Well, I think that's covered everything I wanted to ask, so thank you for your help. I hope that a book does justice to the football club and its players, especially those who fought in the war. I'll send you a copy each with my compliments. So, thanks again, and I'll be on my way.
I'll show you out.
Right. Right.
3 weeks later, I was at the county ground. Heavy overnight rain had delayed the start of the county match, but it gave me a further chance to think back over the interview with George and Reg. Since meeting with George and Reg, I somehow see the so-called Great War in a different light. During those years, I'd written so much about that human tragedy, so much about the progress of the conflict. Material, I later realised, was largely jingoistic propaganda, masking the political and military incompetence. I'd met so many soldiers of all ranks who were actively involved in that pointless human slaughter. Yet, there was always a reluctance to talk about the war. But was that through fear of remembering and reliving those dreadful times? Or was it an angry recognition of the totally pointless waste of life? I usually sensed the latter. No heroic victory in a just war. Only the bloodiest recall of an episode best forgotten. That's what I sensed in all but two of the veterans I'd met, and those two were George and Reg. No condemnation, no railing against the military leaders, just a job that was tough but needed doing. Were footballers different from other men? Is there something in their very nature that makes them compete without hatred or enmity? A game to be won? Let's hope that we may never again have cause for such conjecture. I also reflected on the treatment of the suffragettes, the summary execution of the leaders of the Easter Rising, and the imposition of severe reparations on Germany, and wondered whether they were all examples of overreaction, causing the opposite effect of that intended. Certainly there was an upsurge in support for those causes, and the Nazis were able to use the reparations for propaganda purposes before gaining power. Incidentally, the England team did give the Nazi salutes on the advice, or was it the instruction, of the British ambassador to Germany, Sir Neville Henderson, but any propaganda benefit to the Nazis was offset by the result of the game. Germany 3, England 6. Some of the Nazi hierarchy were there, Goebbels, Goering and von Ribbentrop, but not Hitler. Jim Gibson was not chosen for the tour, so was spared the dilemma of choosing whether or not to give the salute. As I reflected on this, I came to the conclusion that giving the salute was only a gesture and would have no bearing on whether there was a war or not. If Hitler was intent on taking over other countries, he was not likely to be influenced one way or another by it. My thoughts were interrupted by a loudspeaker announcement. The play would commence in half an hour. So, back to the day job. The book would have to wait until the evening. I just hoped that when it was published, George and Reg would feel that it did justice to them and their comrades, from both the football field and the battlefield.
The Gesture was written by Howard Jones and performed by the Bare Bones Theatre Company with the following cast. Philip Morris was played by Howard Jones. Maggie by Amanda Watkins. George by Dave Baldwin, Reg by Gordon Stewart, and Elsie by Valerie Vaughan Williams. The play was recorded and produced at the Froxfield Studios, Herefordshire, by Dave Baldwin.